Hi, I'm Terry, Instagram's sassy sober mum. Welcome to my podcast, Sober Stories from Everyday People. Bringing you stories from people just like you and I, the aim of this podcast is to share our experiences with drinking and how we got and stayed successfully sober. You can now access most of my coaching and guidance through my Thrive Sober online video course. This is an easy to follow course containing 50 videos with backed up writing and recommendations that can be worked through in your own time. There is a brilliant app that you can download to access the course on your phone or your tablet. You can skip through the course choosing content you most need in that moment, or you can work through them from 1 to 50 in order. You can come back to the learning or redo sections to help with parts of emotional sobriety that you are struggling with. The course covers holidays, summertime, Christmas, socializing, what to read, identifying and coping with triggers, complacency, the 100-day moderation trap, breaking down old beliefs, managing your thoughts, sugar cravings, and plenty more. You will also get a free copy of my Thrive Sober ebook in the introduction section. Visit www.thrivesobercoaching.com/course to learn more or get access. Use coupon code HALFPRICE to get 50% off. I've had so many messages from people that say the ebook and the course together has been the thing to get them over the line and achieving their first 100 days successfully sober. Hello and welcome to Sober Stories from Everyday People. Today I'm talking to Steph from London, who's been sober for 4 years, 2 months and 5 days. Thank you so much for joining me today, Steph. Really looking forward to getting into your story. We had a little chit chat before we came on record. So yeah, why don't you tell us a bit about yourself so that we can get a bit of a flavour of who you are?
Well, there's a lot for a start. I'm 52, turning 53 this year. Having a lovely time in midlife. I work in advertising, which is a bit of an animal, but my background is fashion and I always work with fashion clients until recently. And I basically just want to have a lovely time. And I think it's really important to talk about having a lovely time in midlife because there's a lot of negative stuff around it. But also, heads up, ladies, drinking is going to ruin your midlife. Anywho. I grew up in Australia, as you can tell from my accent, and I'm a dual citizen, so I tend to choose to live in this country because I really love it. It's in Europe, so there I am.
Aww. Well, it's lovely to meet you, and I'm very grateful that you're coming onto my show to share your story. And you mentioned that you actually hadn't spoken much about your sobriety.
No.
So this is quite new for you.
It is really new for me because for want of sounding like negative, I just didn't want to bang on about it. I really don't like people banging on about something. Like I one of my friends a few years ago became a vegan and then that turned into their entire personality. And I was like, oh, help me. I didn't want to do that. And also, I mean, to be really straight, I just felt really ashamed.
Yeah.
That's the truth of it. I still to this day, which is ridiculous, I still feel a great sense of shame about it, which is absurd because it's nothing to be ashamed of. You know, we're humans. We have so many different experiences and we live our lives in such different fluid ways. It's not a linear process being alive, you know, but it's a bit embarrassing to say, actually, I just was a raging alcoholic. And the minute you say it out loud, you're like, oh. Because society's kind of association with alcoholism is somebody who's like desolate, sitting on the pavement, you know, filthy and homeless and drinking out, you know, methylated spirits, you know, but you can still be an alcoholic if you spend £10 on a bottle of Pinot Grigio.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? There is so much stigma attached to that. And actually, there's a lot of stigma about a lot of things, which we don't have to delve into too much.
But there's a world of that.
There is. And I think that I'm hoping that these sorts of conversations, they help to shift the narrative a bit.
Because yeah, me too.
Absolutely right. Like, there are so many people that struggle with drinking or have a problematic relationship, whether they call themselves alcoholic or not. And at the end of the day, it's just most people aren't happy in that place.
No,
and it's the really hard part. And
it is. And it's interesting you should say that, because first it starts off as fun and then it becomes a habit, and habitual behavior is so difficult to step away from, because all of a sudden everything in your world is wrapped up in it. And I mean, I remember I voiced it out loud to a friend of mine many years ago, where I said, God, I really, really need to stop drinking. We were in the pub at lunchtime at work, by the way, when I had this conversation as I was drinking rosé, and which was standard fare for my industry.
Advertising London.
Yeah, it's all there.
20 years ago was probably, there's a lot of drinking in the day.
Well, it still is now. It's just more hidden. That's all. But there was at this point, this is maybe 5 years ago, 6 years ago. And I said, and he said, well, why don't you? And I said, because I would lose all my friendship group. My husband, who wasn't my husband at the time, our whole life is based around this. And I suddenly realized as soon as I'd said it, that it was true. And I was like, dang, Skippy. There it is.
I think that puts a lot of people off as well. I know when people reach out to me, so many people are afraid of how getting sober or, you know, stopping drinking is going to impact their relationships, particularly their partners, husbands, wives, etc. It's a real obstacle. It's a real mental obstacle for people.
Yeah, because you have to have the very hard conversation with yourself, which comes down to, would I spend my time with these people if there was no drinks? I love going to the pub with my friends. Yes, I did. But if the pub suddenly wasn't serving alcohol, I don't want to go to the pub with my friends. Like, it was just a vessel to get me close to more booze that felt more socially acceptable than woofing two bottles of rosé by myself on the sofa having a lovely time, which drinking alone was always much nicer than drinking with everyone else, because then I could shut all the noise off in my head.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So it's...
And you suddenly realize, in that situation, you're doing it in private and you're not being judged. I think that's the...
No accountability, is there?
There's a big element there. Where I think being watched or perceived in a certain way or judged, like, that's just, I just remember as a drinker, that was horrible. I hated that. Probably because of some deep psychological level, I knew what I looked like in the mirror. Like, I knew that behavior was not great, but just quite wrapped up in denial and believing the glam.
Yeah. And then also wrapped up a little bit kind of in that sort of social trick. I mean, alcohol marketing, it's the best. Honestly, it really is. It's one of those things that, you know, they sell you this fun, all the fun kids are doing it and everyone is happy and together and connected and social and they have a lovely time, and if you're not part of that, then you're boring and you're not having any fun. And I used to really buy into that.
Yeah.
I used to really kind of buy into that kind of, well, my friends and I are having more fun because, you know, we're bonding, and we were to some point and it was really fun, but there was never an end point. It always ended up, you know, it's all fun and giggles until somebody shits on it. You know, it's really that. It's like, it's all fun until it isn't.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden when it's not fun is when you realize that you could easily have a glass of wine for breakfast. And I have done that.
Mm-hmm.
Which is embarrassing and actually really shameful. But I say to anyone who's been that person, you know, it's okay. You just need to have a hard conversation with yourself and don't do it on your own. I did it all on my own, and that was a dumbass thing to do for a start. I mean, don't do that. You know, but it's true. You have to have a hard conversation about whether the same people that you drink with, the same people you wouldn't drink with.
Yeah.
That's tricky.
Yeah.
So that fear is really valid. Mm. I mean, especially these days, you know, where we are so disconnected from a lot of things. I mean, you and I are talking through a screen,
yeah.
And we're connecting through a screen, and because of our personalities, that's easy.
Yeah.
Because, you know, but if you weren't of this ilk, you'd shy away from it. So where we have less of that, interaction, don't know, it's tricky. You have to really assess whether or not you'd still do those things with those people. And sometimes the answer is yes, and sometimes the answer is actually no, I wouldn't. Yeah. And that's okay, because they probably wouldn't with you either.
Yeah,
you know. Exactly, because you'd be the boring one and, you know, nobody wants
one. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's quite a difficult thing. I think it's society's favourite drug, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. It's favoured by everyone. It's you know, health professionals, big professional people.
Yeah. And also it's that kind of thing that you can buy it anywhere.
Mm.
I mean, I don't know what it's like now, but growing up in Australia, you couldn't buy alcohol anywhere but the alcohol place.
The bottle shop.
Yes, the bottle-o.
Yeah, I remember that from my travels.
Yeah, you had to go to a place that just sold alcohol. You couldn't just pop to the supermarket, pick up your weekly shop, six bottles of on special. You couldn't do that. So, and other places that I've spent a lot of time in Sweden, they have really strict rules around alcohol as well. But they have a massive drinking problem as a country, but it's very well hidden. But you know, so here in the UK, it's literally just staring you in the face. So you don't even have to kind of be accountable for like scoring. Like it's not even shady.
I know. Yeah. Even in the time that I've stopped drinking, 5 years, the percentage of alcohol has grown so much. So
yeah,
just the strength of alcohol that you can get access to just around the corner as well. It's so big.
Yeah.
You know, it's like big craft boutique beers.
Oh,
5, 6, 7.
Loaded.
Yeah. Ciders, same.
Well, people joke about Stella being wife beater.
Yeah.
Get craft beer, that'll be factors.
Yeah, wasn't it? Yeah.
Stella's not even strong compared to what you can get in a, you know. I know, it's a really weird thing. But there is also this other kind of wave that I've only really noticed since being sober. There's a lot of people who don't drink, and there's a lot of things on the market. I think for me, understanding what that market looked like is one of the agencies I worked in. One of our clients was Heineken. And I found out that, you know, Heineken sell more non-alcoholic than they sell alcoholic beer.
Isn't that amazing? Yeah.
That is. And to be honest, if I was going to have a non-alcoholic beer, I would have a Heineken because it's the best. It tastes the nicest. But it's like there is a huge movement of people. There's lots and lots of non-alcoholic things. And you've got generations behind me. I'm obviously bang middle Gen X. So I was like rife for all the good times. I was a party girl. I was an Ibiza girl. I was 17 at the beginning of the rave culture, and I was all in, you know. So it's been a lifetime of that. And the generations behind us are not like that. Like my daughter and her friends, they're, you know, they do drink alcohol, but they don't drink it like we did. It's very much a kind of a social treat, and they don't like being drunk. It's embarrassing.
Well, like it's also a complication of social media.
100%.
I was getting Snapchat chatted when I was drunk in the park at 15. You know, I couldn't cope. I wouldn't cope. Like, I would be getting probably quite bullied for it. I mean, it would just be awful.
Yeah. So I get that, you know, but it's sort of what it means is there's a real change.
Yeah.
There's a big change. In fact, someone I work with, they have family that live in Japan, and apparently in Japan, the Gen Z drinks so little that their entire whiskey industry is falling down the hole.
Yeah, brilliant. Hashtag sorry, not sorry.
Do you know what? Because and it's a little bit, I mean, I put alcohol in the same category as like seed oils. They were built for machinery. Like, you're just drinking ethanol. And this is the thing, is that I'm not the sort of person that when someone drinks, I say, oh, did you know that you're just drinking? You know, I don't do that because it's easier for me, and this is a real contradiction, it's easier for me to socialise with people who are drinking because it's less work for me socially. Because the one thing I discovered when I gave up drinking is my social battery is pea-sized.
Yeah.
Pea-sized. Even people I like to be around, an hour in, I'm like, oh, I'm exhausted. You know, so if they're, I don't want to have, a lot of people say they love having those more connected conversations. I don't. I actually find them really hard work. And so for me, when I socialize, I want to have silly, frivolous chit chat. I want to have like, you know, giggly things. And that's what alcohol used to help me have. And now if someone else around me isn't drinking, I'm thinking, oh, that's going to be a bit tricky. Even people I really, really care for. So it's that's contradictive, really, isn't it? It's like I'm happy for everyone else around me to be drinking because it's easier for me. But I know that given my nature and how I've dealt with alcohol, that I just can't do it. Yeah. I just can't.
Yeah.
And proof is in the pudding, you know, when you give it up, you feel it takes a while. It took me a long time, but I protect my sobriety. I sometimes have dreams that I drink. Isn't so weird? I'm curious to know if anyone else has ever had this actually.
Oh, it's hugely common.
Is it? Okay, great. Because I have dreams that I'm drinking in my dream. I wake up and I'm horrified.
Yeah.
I'm mortified. I'm devastated. The thought of putting back my daily tracker to zero is literally... So I'm kind of laughing at myself because as I'm saying this, I realize this is horribly true, but the thought of losing my sobriety just makes me feel so devastated that I can't comprehend that.
Yeah.
Isn't that the weirdest thing?
No, it's not. I actually think it's the brain's way of reminding you of how awful it would be to go back to drinking. It's extremely common. And
is it? Okay, really great.
Early on as well, like first 100 days, it's really common.
First 100 days, what a whirlwind.
So let's go back a little bit. So before we do that, like talk to me, you mentioned there about being 17 on the rave scene and I was a little bit behind you, but I remember that rave scene. I wasn't old enough to go to some of these private raves in fields and just
We were.
We would have been, yeah. I was kind of more like listening to the rave stuff on my Walkman, on my tape from years ago.
Excellent, ready?
Yeah, exactly. They would record the tape and I would be able to listen to it, you know, and I was like 14, 15 or whatever.
Yeah.
So yeah, let's talk to me about your relationship with drinking and kind of starting when you started drinking. Like, what did that look like?
Well, it's really bizarre. And this is going to kind of, I'm quite emotionally mature. So I think I probably as a teenager was not only very naive, I had a really normal childhood. So when I say normal, I come from, it was really unremarkable. And I don't mean that as an insult. My parents are just, you know, nice people. I grew up in a nice environment. I didn't have anything amazing happen to me. I didn't have anything horrible happen to me. Do you know what I mean? My parents aren't raging drink. You know, there's nothing in there that you'd say, I see what happened here. There's not really anything there. So in all fact, it's all just my own fault. All just me, and kind of accepting that it's all just me. Like most things in my life, it is really just my own silly fault. And when you kind of get to the nuts of it, and you realise it is just your own fault, you're like, okay, I better get myself out of this because no one else got me in here. And that's kind of, I am quite hyper independent. My parents are very much of the fact that you're going to work out things yourself. So I kind of grew myself up to a certain point, and with alcohol, I remember first drinking it when I was about 14, I suppose, with my friends. And obviously, I grew up on the beach. I come from a harbour suburb in Sydney, and I grew up on the beach. Mm-hmm. And I grew up around quite a lot of, not that I was this sort of family, but I grew up around a lot of really unsupervised, wealthy children. And I was not those people, but I would have loved to have been, obviously, but I was. And I grew up around a lot of kids that weren't very heavily supervised, had a lot of access to money, and weren't really, it was the 80s, and no one's parents were really that interested in their kids. Not like we are now. We're super involved. We're like, pull on in.
Yeah.
But you were sort of just expected to just grow up and just be a kid.
Got on with it, didn't you? Like, my parents never bothered about was I entertained at a weekend. It was just like, they wouldn't really adjust any of their life for me. Like, they
nor me, nor any of us.
No, it would just sort of tag along, you know.
It just was different. It was a different.
It was, wasn't it?
And when I say this, I'm going to sound like I wear pantaloons from the 1800s, but it was a different time.
Yes.
It was a different time.
Yeah,
it was. And we were sort of just, we just kind of were outside most of the time and doodling on our roller skates. But drinking for me, I can remember thinking that I had a few friends who loved being drunk, loved it. And I hated being drunk. I hated being drunk. And to even throughout my whole life, I hate the feeling of being drunk. Which is hilarious because obviously I was drunk ass most of the time, but I hate the feeling of being drunk. I hate it. I don't like that feeling of not being in control. I don't like that. And so I never ever really got drunk as my friends did. I kind of joined in because I wanted to see what the fuss was about, but most of the time it just annoyed me. But I actually liked the feeling, and if I'd known at the time and I told someone, I wish someone had known what this meant, but the only thing I liked was the fact that all of a sudden, all the noise in my head, all the carry-on, all of the undiagnosed ADHD suddenly was quiet. I was like, oh, I could finally do my homework. This is great. And that was very alluring.
Yeah. Yeah. We talked about this, didn't we? Because we're both...
both late bloggers. Yeah.
Proud. And, yeah, we talked about similarities of how prevalent ADHD is becoming in this community, number one, especially
100%
women. But I don't know whether that's especially with women. It mainly, probably that's
because I mostly talk a lot. But men with ADHD also have massive substance abuse problems. It's part of the way the brain functions, and you know, it's not uncommon, is it? And we know that.
And, it's not uncommon, and I think that a lot of what resonates with me with ADHD is that all or nothing.
Oh, 100%. Like, I'm all in.
Yeah, I'm all in or I'm just not asked. Do you know what I mean? And but most of the time, if it's slightly alluring or there's a big high or dopamine here or whatever you want to, I'm all in. Get me there.
Well, I am as well, but I'm a really good masker, and I have been my whole life. And I also am quite self-disciplined to the point where I knew this about myself really young, like super young. I knew that there was something in me that was always going to be all in or not in at all. And so I purposely sort of almost controlled myself to the point where I threw myself into going to the gym, and I became totally... It was the 80s. It was easy to be like this. I was totally obsessed with looking and being the best I could be. And alcohol didn't work with that because it got in the way. So I sort of purposely sort of diverted my kind of desire for dopamine hit into exercise. And I got a big hit from it, and I was addicted to it, and I loved it. And I was really, really fit and like physically fit. And I was teetotal. From about, I think, 18 and 19, I was completely teetotal.
This gym thing was in focus.
It was in focus. It was the forefront of my mind. It was my biggest focus. And, I mean, when I was 17, my mates and I, we were wild. We were so out of hand. It was ridiculous because we were in the rave scene. We were super young for the rave scene. We had a lot of older friends, and we had a great time. But when my best friend went to live in England, she went to visit in England, and we sort of grew apart a bit. I threw myself into exercise, and I was teetotal for 2 years because I was really controlling, and I could get a dopamine hit. I was like, okay, I'm getting one. And then when I actually moved to London in my early 20s, I suddenly was like, oh my God, there's so much here. And guess what? No one cares. Okay, so the thing I love about England is that people really don't care. You can do what you want. You can wear what you want. You can say what you want. No one cares. That you're not important enough to anybody. You're in a big town. No one cares. They just don't. And there's something a little bit liberating about that.
So it's edgy, isn't it? I mean, especially from a suburban area or...
Well, I come from Sydney, I come from central Sydney. But Sydney, you know, Australia has a very defined lifestyle. And it's sort of, you live that kind of lifestyle, but it's still quite small, you have to remember. Whereas, and people still have this sort of societal class and behavior. When I was growing up, there was. When I got to London, there were so many different cultures and there were so many different people and so many different kind of types of people where I was growing up. And I think it's quite true. In England, you could have a housing estate right next door to a millionaire's house. In Sydney, it's not like that. If you're on social housing, you're probably living in a different part of Sydney. So you don't get that much diversity inside the suburb I grew up in. When I got to London, everyone was different. Everyone was having a wild time. It didn't really matter. And no one cared. And so all these things were super accessible. And I was having a fine old time. Yeah. You know, my mates and I would chase the music. And with the music came everything. It came, you know, the party. It came the drink. It came the drugs. It came all the fun stuff. And that fun stuff didn't just happen in London. It happened in Ibiza and it happened in Ayia Napa. And we were all part of that. We were having the best time ever. And so, and also you've got to remember, I'm the generation where lad culture, ladette girls, we were the right age. We were also the right age for Sex and the City. So all those cocktails and gossip and being city girls and working in London, all of that, I was the right age every time for every hit of kind of bad behavior. I was the perfect like consumer because I was exactly the right age.
Yeah, same. Spice Girls, which I know, you know, now at the age we are now, you think, oh god, the Spice Girls, but at the time,
yeah, you would have been Spice Girls, exactly.
Yeah, girl empowerment and all of that stuff. Like that was
old. Yeah.
Maybe you were, but for me, it was I was just on the cusp of maybe being a bit too old, but so I was still quite in the group of being able to, you know, accept
that kind of girl power. We can do what you want. Power. We don't need a man to take us out. We'll take ourselves out.
Yeah, that nobody was having. You know, that was the first time suddenly this stuff was bursting on the scene, and then there was Britney Spears, and there's just all this, all these big, big female, like quite iconic people bursting on the scene, and with that was also the kind of like ladette culture. So you felt quite unstoppable.
Well, you did, especially as the collective. I mean, I dare any man to approach a bunch of 10, 25-year-old girls who are full of rosé, living their best life, empowered to the hill. Good luck, mate. But it was that, wasn't it? And, yeah, and I think knowing I had a problem with alcohol and trying to control it, I kind of just stopped controlling it because I just was having too much fun. So I just dug straight in, and it became very much part of my character to be quite known as quite wild, sort of party girl, you know, someone who'd always be dancing on the bar. And I'm quite extrovert, obviously, anyway, and I'm quite full on because, you know, that's my character. And it just was a perfect vessel for the music I loved. And there was nothing better than in the 90s, dancing on the bar at DC10 in your bikini after not going to bed for 2 days with champagne in your hand.
Yeah.
It was great. And you felt fabulous and you felt free and you felt like you were so glamorous and so not boring and so not sensible. And that was so alluring.
Appealing, yeah.
You know, it really was. But you can't do that forever. And what comes after that is when those things... I mean, some people can do it forever, but I'd like to see what state they're in. But, you know, and when that kind of falls away, you're left with the reality that you really do have a drinking problem because it's unsustainable to be jumping on party drugs all the time. And that sort of falls away. Well, it did for me because I was like,
I think it's really hard to press the pause button on that lifestyle. That's certainly what I found. I was the same as you. It was all fun. And even if there was a lot, even if there was a bit of next day anxiety, I could quickly wash that away with a Bloody Mary or
100%
spend some money or do something.
Yeah.
But I didn't have kids. I wasn't married. And I didn't have a sort of serious, serious career. It was just like work to get money to party and have fun. But when I did start doing those more grown up things, I couldn't turn the throttle down. Do you know what I mean?
Like, it doesn't work.
I couldn't do that. So I was just maintaining the old lifestyle, but trying to fit that into the new lifestyle of being like early 30s, mid 30s, kids coming, wanting to sit down. And like that then started to, plus as well, I do think that when you've caned it for 10, 15 years, 20 years, it's starting to take its toll on your mental
it is
on all that stuff. So I think that's when it got really, really difficult for me. And I think that's quite similar for quite a lot of people.
I'd say that's a pretty similar path for a lot of people. But then the joy of alcohol marketing is they market it towards mothers, mummy wine time, rosé with your girlfriends. Oh, the kids are all asleep. You know, it's marketed, and when you have a baby, as you probably will know, you're on your own.
Mm.
You really are, and doesn't matter how many people love you and how many people support you, but it basically comes down to you and a baby. And it's not to discredit anything that anyone ever does, because I mean, with my daughter, her dad is incredible. He's a wonderful father, and he had and still has the biggest part of her life. And it's not that he wasn't there. That's not it at all. It's the fact that you suddenly have to adjust yourself to kind of parenting, and it's hard, and it's not what you think it's going to be, and no one really tells you the truth. And then you sort of find the solidarity with your girlfriends, you know, if you can. And if you don't have that, then you have reward yourself for getting through your day with a glass of wine. I used to count down till 6 o'clock, and that's when I knew I had a massive issue with it, and I just didn't know what to do. I kind of figured it would sort of play itself out.
Yeah.
Sounds really naive, doesn't it? I mean, when I say that now, it's like hoping that, you know, any obsession is going to play itself out. It is going to play itself out, but not well.
Yeah, but I do. I mean, I've done similar things, you know, just like the whole breastfeeding and waiting until the baby's gone down. Like, I can have 2 glasses of wine now, so long as I stop at this point. I mean, it's all quite.
Yeah, or just using all the breast milk in the freezer. Here you go. Yeah.
Dumping because you've gone a bit too crazy with it.
Yeah.
Let's get a formula. You know, they're not the times that you look back on and feel proud of, are they? But
no,
and I think they are common.
I think they're common as well. And I mean, I mean, my daughter's my life to me, and there's big parts of me. There's a lot of shame I feel about it, if I'm honest. And I feel really sad that perhaps she could have had a better version of me. I mean, I when I mentioned this to her, she goes, "I don't remember anything. I'm having a great time." I'm like, "Oh, thank God." But you know, my daughter's a very particularly fabulous little human who's very kind of not grown up, but she's quite matter of fact. So, you know, I kind of think to myself, is that just her kind of getting on with being alive? But in saying that, since I have got sober, I have such a nicer relationship. That's not true. I always have a beautiful relationship with my daughter, but I feel that the relationship I have with her now is better than it would have been if I was a drinker.
Mm. So you would have got sober when she just hit her teens then? If she's 17 and you...
Yes, I did. I actually decided to go sober in lockdown.
Yeah.
And I did it because all of the things that I was worried about, like losing my life as it looked, well, they got whipped out from under us really quickly. And I was like, oh my God, I'm not commuting to London every day, you know, because living right on the edge of London meant I had a commute. I'm not to my office in central London. I'm not kind of working extortionate hours and then going to the pub at lunchtime, which was standard. I'm not going having drinks after work. I'm not coming home and not eating dinner and drinking a glass of wine. I'm not doing all of that. I'm here. I've got some breathing space. And I very quickly, in the first few weeks of lockdown, I was like, oh, good grief, if I don't actually do this now, this will kill me. You know, I mean, alcohol consumption lockdown for the nation went through the roof.
Yeah, it did. Yeah, it's like for people, for regular drinkers, it was like three times as bad or something like that.
It was terrible. In fact, it kind of spawned a lot of people who actually had quite clear boundaries about drinking. Like, I used to work with lots of people that never drank at home, ever. They drink a lot out of home. All of a sudden, they were like, well, I'm going to drink at home. And that changed a lot. And so I decided that I was like, I'm quite opportunistic when it comes to things. And I thought, I've got an opportunity here. I'm not going to be like, oh, I can't come out. I can't do this. Oh, no, I can't do that. Having to explain myself. I thought, I'll just quietly and secretly stop drinking. No one's going to notice. If I went onto calls where people were having drinks, I just have a wine glass full of pink tonic. No one even questioned it.
Yeah.
You know, like, I sort of secretly quit drinking, which is hilarious because I don't know. I sort of secretly did it. I'm not quite sure why, but I can be quite secretive, actually.
Yeah. It's
sort of my nature.
but it's a brilliant time.
Oh,
weirdly, to do it, even though you could also argue it's a brilliant time to still be drinking because there's so much collective
angst,
anxiety and trauma going on. You think, yeah. Oh, I need to get through it. But to actually just be like, no, I'm going to use this opportunity to stop, I think is really, really fascinating. And
I think it was one of my moments of genius. I'm not usually good with timing, but this was a good one. Yeah, usually my timing's horribly off, but I reckon my timing's all right here. But I kind of pondered with the idea.
I was going to say, did you have conversations with yourself for a long time about stopping?
Oh, 100%. The amount of times I Googled, do I have an alcohol problem, is almost like hilarious. And in fact, I think I woke up one morning, it was a Saturday, and I'd had like a standard, maybe two bottles of rosé the night before, which is pretty standard. I woke up feeling a bit fuzzy, but nothing. I was used to feeling like that. That was standard feeling. And I turned around to my other half and I went, I'm going to stop drinking. And he went, all right then. And I did. That was it. But I make that sound like, oh yeah, I just did that. No. I was Googling about a week before, do I have an alcohol problem? And it brought up all these different articles. And I found an article written by Claire Pooley. And it had a link to her book. And I thought, and something in the article just hooked me. And I thought, I wonder. And I got the book on Kindle. Didn't even get the real book because, you know, in denial about the fact that I was actually doing this. It was bizarre. I read it the same day. I got it. I'm a fast reader because I get obsessed with reading, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
And I read it in a day, under a day. I read it the day I got it.
It's a great book.
Do you know what? And this is going to sound awful to anyone who knows me, and I don't mean it in any way, but I'm not somebody who's easily kind of influenced by kind of other people being role models. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not someone who's like, oh, I'm so inspired by that person. I'm not. I don't really feel a connection to it. But I read that book and I thought, oh, sweet baby Jesus, that she's me. That's me. Except I'm not living in West London. It's fabulous. You know,
this is the Sober Diaries.
The Sober Diaries book. I read it and it fundamentally, something inside me latched onto that book. I don't know what it was, and I just was like, oh well, if she can do it,
yeah,
then I can do it.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm gonna do it. So I did. And then I think I did that on the Tuesday before the Saturday. And in that time between the Tuesday and the Saturday, I went wild on the internet. I was like researching and I found a whole world of sobriety. And I thought, oh my God, it's not just me. There's a bajillion people who are in this big mess. Wow, there's a whole world out there. And I'd never seen it because I was too busy, you know, having fun.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh. And I thought, geez, should I join some of these groups? And I thought, no, that's not for me. I'm not an organized fun person, because I had been to AA before. Hilariously, many years earlier, I walked into AA in Soho. However, I turned on my heel because the first thing I heard was something to do with God. And I thought, oh, the hell no. And I got out. I turned around on my heel and went to the pub. I was like, groups are not for me. I'm not a group person. That's not for me. So I sort of started researching, and I found this website called Love Sober by Kate Mandy.
I know, yeah. Fabulous girls.
Do you know what? Between Kate Mandy and Claire Pooley, those three unknowingly changed the course of my life and probably saved me, because I only found out about 6 months ago I was born with one kidney.
Gosh.
And miraculously, it's perfect. I don't even deserve that kidney, do I?
Yeah, of course you do. Of course you do.
You know what I mean? It's like,
that's crazy. Let's find that out at over
50. In my 50s, I was like, yeah. What? One kidney? They're like, yeah, you're born with one kidney. I was like, eh? Crazy talk.
No, I don't even know. Maybe I've got one kidney. Who knows? I swear.
Well, you'd know if you were scanned, but I was born in 1971. They didn't scan mums. They wouldn't have been picked up when I was in my mum's tummy, as it were.
They didn't scan on the level that they scan now.
I was a healthy child. So, you know, when I told my mum, she was like, what? I was like, I know. Weird. But yeah, apparently it's genetic, but it seems to just be me. Anyway, but yeah, collectively, those three women changed everything for me. And I actually wrote an email to Claire Pooley almost immediately saying how much her book changed my life. And she replied to me, and I was like, oh, it was a big deal. Yeah. And I did the Love Sober course, the 3-month course, where I forced myself to do something I hate doing, which is journaling. I hate journaling. I don't want to write down anything that's in my head. I'd be at it all day.
I love journaling. Did you get into it?
No, I didn't. And I wish I had, that's being really honest, but I did it. Mm. And just the process of having to do that every day. Mm. I also started learning Spanish again. So I used to journal in Spanish as well as English to practice Spanish.
That's quite amazing. You are
very bad Spanish, let me be clear. My Spanish is a lot better now.
That's unbelievable. Yes, not even like journaling in Spanish.
Well, I did it in Spanish as well as English because I wanted to practice my Spanish. It was all in present tense, so it was always very much in the moment.
That's amazing.
But that 3-month sort of process set me on a path of a routine.
Yeah.
Where I also went on to I Am Sober app, so I count my days. Mm. And in the first sort of 100 days, which is when you're most likely to lapse, right, I found the first feeling was disbelief. I was like, I can't believe I'm actually doing this. I can't believe I'm actually doing this. I am doing it. And my husband drinks, and he's drinking around me quite merry. And I was like, I can't believe I'm doing this. I can't believe it. And then I sort of, then when I'd gone a month sober, I was like, a month sober? What the hell? I couldn't believe it. I literally was disbelief. It was like, me? I haven't had a drink. And of course, from that point onwards, my expectations of being sober became extremely unrealistic.
Mm.
Extremely unrealistic.
Yeah, talk to me about that, because we touched on that.
Yeah.
You were basically telling me before we came online that you found sobriety like quite hard, actually. You didn't get all the joy and all the warm fuzzies for a long time. You just really started to feel it, and obviously a few years in now. So yeah, talk. Can we talk about, so you said the first 100 days were really challenging. Talk about that, and then talk about how that's set up.
So okay, so
difficulty in that first 100 days.
First month, I'd say, was one of disbelief and quite elation. And also I was excited because it was new, as you can relate to. It was a new obsession, new hobby, It was a new hobby. I was excited because I had a new process. It was something I did every day. I couldn't sit still, and I was very busy, and all of a sudden all my cupboards were all cleared, you know, but I was also working really hard. I had very long days. COVID for my husband and I was a very, very challenging time at work. We weren't furloughed. We were picking up the work for people who were furloughed. We were both working 20-hour days. It was exhausting. So I was very busy. I threw myself into it. Very challenging. I kind of had, because I wasn't socializing, not that socializing was my biggest drinking area, drinking at home was my biggest drinking area, because I sort of stopped that, the idea of socializing really bothered me. I was like, I don't really want to have to explain myself.
Mm.
You know, I just don't really want to have to be the one that says, oh, no, thanks, not for me. Well, why not? Knowing I'm always the first in the bar, because, you know, I don't want to do any of that. So it was quite handy. But then my expectation was so disproportionate. For a start, I expected that immediately I would sleep like a baby. I would jump out of bed with the joy of a four-year-old heading off for a lovely time. I would suddenly have skin that glowed. I would be really, really, I'd lose loads of weight. I mean, I've never been a plump person, but I figured I'd look less puffy because I did look, used to look, I had a wine face. Mm. I'd be like, I'm going to feel amazing. I'm going to be super happy. And all of my problems would just skip out the door.
Yeah.
What an idiot. And no word of a lie, that is genuine what I believed. Yeah. It's a little bit, but I'm quite literal. It's like if I read something on a bottle that says, oh, it'll save your skin, I think, right, that's it. I'm going to have a whole facelift by Thursday. So I know what I'm like. But I ignored that about myself. And I was like, first of all, my skin broke out for a good year. My entire face broke out completely. My skin was like getting everything out. It didn't like it. Secondly, I couldn't sleep properly. I was used to passing out.
Mm,
yeah. I had good sleep forever. I couldn't sleep properly. I was always waking up. But it also, when I look back, I realized I was also in perimenopause.
Right. Yeah. But also as well, doesn't, you know, ADHD, a lot of the thing underneath ADHD is actually anxiety as well, which really also interrupts.
Yeah. Do you want to know something hilarious?
Yeah,
well, I always used to think I wasn't an anxious person because I didn't really understand what anxiety was, if I'm really honest. Yeah. I thought anxiety was people who were really highly strong.
Yeah. Yes.
It's not. And I realized that anxiety can show up as like hypervigilance and sort of kind of all different things. And it's a busy brain.
Yes.
Like I can sit still, as you can see, but my brain is like running all the time.
Yeah. Lots going on.
Yeah. So I couldn't sleep because my brain was really busy. Yeah. I was terrified I'd fall off the wagon because I hate failing because I wanted to be perfect at being sober.
And that creates anxiety as well.
It does. I mean, ironically, I wanted to be the best at being sober because
I relate to this a lot. Yeah.
Like, if I'm going to be sober, I'm going to be the best at being sober.
I'm going to fucking do it.
I'm
going
to smash this.
Yeah, I'm going to smash it. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I know. It's so ridiculous that I was like, so failing wasn't an option. Falling off the wagon was never going to happen. Even if I had to bite my own fingers off to not have a drink, it wasn't going to happen. So I knew, because I'm very single bloody minded, just the same way that I'd be like, well, if we're going for drinks, I'm having all the drinks. I was like, well, no, you know,
having any drinks, I am never having a drink.
You know, even to the point where I'm like, Vanilla Essence has got alcohol, like, you know.
Yes.
And so I was kind of constantly playing that out. And then I was sort of stewing on kind of the fact that I felt quite miserable and that I felt really hot and sweaty all the time. And I felt like I was constantly having like alcohol withdrawals, which was probably just perimenopause. But in my mind,
this is perimenopause symptoms.
But at the same time in my brain, I was like, oh, sweet Jesus, I'm falling apart, you know, and I didn't feel good. In fact, I felt quite shit. I felt upset all the time. I couldn't stop being upset. I felt sad at the fact that the person that I was so confident that I was actually going. And I was sad that I wasted all those times kind of fucking around and not paying attention. And I felt like a bit of a failure. I felt like a lot like a failure, especially because I was hitting the age where ageism at work is a really big thing. I then kept getting made redundant and losing my job. And, you know, and I just sort of felt like a massive failure, and I felt that alcohol had robbed me. When, as we already know, it was all my own fault. There's no one to blame except for me. And having to kind of accept that nobody else is to blame but yourself is just the shittiest realization. There's nothing worse than having to realize you've been a twat.
Yeah, although I do feel like that is quite a harsh lens, if I'm being honest. And I understand, obviously, that's how you feel and you have to validate that. But did you ever find, when you found out about your ADHD, when did you get that? Or when did you find out?
Oh, so what happened was I was so depressed that I actually went to the doctor and I said, oh, I don't know. And she referred me to Vitamines, is it called? She referred me for therapy. I had my first therapy session. And my therapist, a lovely woman, she said to me at the end of the session, she went, I'm going to ask you something. I don't want you to dwell on it. She said, but has anyone ever suggested that you have ADHD? And I went, well, actually, in my 20s, I had therapy and they did suggest I had it. And I got very upset and offended and didn't do anything about it.
Interesting.
I know, because I thought it would look like I was a complete failure.
Yeah.
And she was like, I'm actually going to transfer you to someone else. She said, it's not because I don't want to do this. She said, I don't have the skills. Mm-hmm. And she transferred me to someone else. And they were like, okay. She said, I think we need to get you into the system.
Mm-hmm.
About getting diagnosed, because I think it might help you out. Mm. Anyway, the system's about 6 years long.
Yeah, it's a long time, isn't it?
Yeah. So I made the decision to, after saving £400 a month on my travel, I made the decision to get a private diagnosis with the savings I made, and I got one. Uh-huh. I don't take medication because I decided that if they ever ran out, I'd be losing my mind. So I decided.
Been a shortage, hasn't there? Hasn't that been
a shortage? I have two friends who are losing their mind on Concerta, so not having it. And one's a guy, and he really is struggling. But I decided, and once I got that, and we dug into it, I dug into it with my therapist, and it's like, oh well, this is really obvious. And if I was a child now. And it wouldn't have been, it really didn't crack on until I was probably as a teen when my hormones kicked in. I was hiding it very well before then. But then when, I think if you look back and you ask anyone, what was she like as a child versus what she was like as a teenager, there'd be someone would say, oh, it's like someone flipped a switch.
Really?
Yeah, 100%. And, yeah, you just run out of energy to mask it as you get older because you get too tired. And mask it, but as a child, I'm a queen of masking. I can still do it now, you know, quite easily.
That's the bit that I always am very much consumed by thoughts of, where am I masking? What am I doing? You know, it's a weird
for
me, if you've had this same experience, but I feel like I got sober and I really revolutionized who I was. Like I literally went through a process of peeling back the layers, relearning who I was, getting to know myself, feeling very proud in that journey as well, personally.
Yeah, 100%.
But now, 5 years in, I'm like, oh, I'm ADHD. And it's like, oh, God, I feel like that on some level I'm doing
I'll
that.
Do it again.
Do it again. It's like, oh, my God. So is that real? Is that real?
Do I really
like talking to people? Do I, you know, why? And it's just, I find that really muddling. I'm in a real muddle.
It's so muddling. And I've actually taken the very wild approach that I don't care if I'm masking or not. And the reason I say that is because I think there's a lot of struggles with having ADHD. A lot of my struggles are always about I'm not very good at emotional regulation. And as such, because I'm not good at it, I've managed to actually turn off my emotions a bit. So I'm a bit emotionally dead. Which is a horrible thing to say, but being in the beginning because when I drank a lot of alcohol, my emotions were really, really unregulated. I could swing from being really angry.
Highs and lows. Yeah.
Highs and lows. And those sort of leveled out a little bit. And then I sort of trained myself kind of to sort of be emotionally quite placid. And now I'm a little bit emotionally dead inside. And I sort of, I need to do some work on that. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't have got to this point of zero if I was still drinking, because I'd still be running away from all the noise.
Yeah.
It's nothing worse than knowing you have to sit yourself down and have a good old look.
Yes. Yes.
And it's very daunting.
It is daunting, but then kind of going back to what started this little...
Oh, yeah, yeah, of course. Sorry, I told you, but it's not ADHD, totally off track.
That was my fault, because I went down there for a reason.
Yeah.
I thought I went down that track. It was that, you know, knowing that you were ADHD and knowing how some of that or a lot of that impacts...
A lot of that.
Drinking, the decision-making... Are you able to look through a more compassionate lens? Because, you know, you are, and I don't know whether you're being a little bit kind of jokey when you say, I was stupid and that was all me.
I am very harsh on myself. I'm
a person. It's quite harsh. Like, it's
very, very harsh. I'm super independent. No, I can't. I think it comes from growing up feeling that I was expected to be responsible for myself at a young age, which was, my parents tried to instill that sense of, you know, growth, and I'm sure it came from a good place. But as a result, I felt that if I was ever in a problem, I had to sort out myself, because I'd probably got myself into it. And being like that from a very young age means that I'm very hyper-independent. You know,
quite a lot of shame energy in that.
A lot of shame energy. And also I have got myself into some fantastic messes in my life.
Yes.
I mean, I really have. I mean, they've been astronomical. And also, I mean, some of them, if I actually was to voice them out loud, you just laugh and say, you've got to be joking. I mean, some of them are fantastic. I've got myself into
I relate to this, because I've just gone through my assessment for ADHD, and you have to bring that stuff out into the light.
Yeah, you do. I know.
When I was kind of regurgitating my past, I was often finding myself nervously laughing, because it's like, this just sounds fucking mental. Like, I just sound crazy. And some of the things that I've done or gotten into, there is embarrassment for that, but I think
it's so embarrassing.
It is embarrassing, but I think the overriding feeling for me was I felt a bit sad for myself, because I didn't know any better in a way. So it's kind of almost like it's not my fault because I'm ADHD, and you know, ADHD is not a choice.
No, it's the way your brain
is. Way, and you are much more likely to have these highs and lows and make these bad decisions. And
you're also more likely to be in an abusive relationship, which I've been, which was horrific.
Yes.
You're much likely to be, you don't hold friendships for a long time, or you stuff things up, or there's a whole world. There's every job I've ever had, I got made redundant from. Except for one. And I was like, wow, I never knew this before. And so I had to really, so this is where that diagnosis in the middle of all this then led me to have to do those things and actually look back, which I never do. I don't like to look back and actually dig into it. And it all becomes really clear. And doing that, I felt like a crazy person. I felt like I must be the most unhinged human just walking around in plain sight. And having to talk to, like, you know, part of my assessment, having to talk about, and then talking about with my therapist, I was like, now you're not going to believe this, but when I was, and I'd say it, and I'd tell her the real truth of it, she'd look at me and goes, no, I believe it. I'd be like, shit. Yeah. And I actually, the more I talk about it, because you live so many different lives when you have ADHD, especially when you've got a drinking problem, which 100% goes hand in hand, or a drug problem, or some kind of reliance problem. And you realize that all those impulsive decisions that you make get fueled by the dopamine, and it's a real vicious cycle. And coming out of that, I felt really depressed. And then I actually felt like I was grieving for little me, you know, and then I was grieving for drunk me. And then I just wanted to say to little me and drunk me, you know what, you're fine. You were always enough. You weren't, you know, you don't need to be perfect. Not that I ever was. But you don't, you know, you're allowed to make mistakes. And just because you were disordered.
Experience to make mistakes.
Yeah, yeah. And also that whole kind of, you know, I felt really sad for little me because I was so on my own all the time. Mm. I've always been on my own.
It's like if you think about your own children, you know, for me, I have neurodivergent child, probably children, you know.
It's genetic.
It's just that when I feel so protective of them, and I want so much for them to grow up feeling enough and to just not have to face the things that I face, because they have ultimate support. I want them to be who they are. I don't want them to be anything. I don't want them to hit all societal norms or tick all the boxes. I don't care. I don't care about that stuff. But in my childhood, that was important.
It was very important in mine as well.
Fit into that box. And I think that's ultimately a big part of the reason why I drank and overdrank, was always just desperation to fit in and desperation to be liked.
Especially when you know in your heart as a small child that you're a bit different. I knew I was different. I knew I was different to everyone else, and not different. And other people would probably view it as I thought I was extra special. But I didn't. I just genuinely knew that my life would never look like everyone else's. I mean, I grew up in an area where a lot of people around me were extremely wealthy and had a lot more privilege than me, even though I do come from a certain level of privilege. So I was always conscious that I was always not one of them. I was always trying really hard to be. I had to be the funny one because I wasn't the pretty one and I wasn't the rich one. So I better be funny. Do you know what I mean? And alcohol helped me be funnier, and I was super funny. But guess what? I'm funny without alcohol. So there.
Yeah. I mean, that was one of the things that when I did socialize a bit, when I was in the early days of not drinking, most of the people that I was with would say, oh my God, you don't need alcohol.
Yeah,
me too. You need to have a drink, you know.
I
would be higher than all of them in the room, just on my own or with, you know, Diet Coke or whatever.
That's the same with me. And
I don't know how much of that, like, that's the thing, is I think, have I always been like that? Or did I learn to be like that from a really young age? That bit is where I find my muddle at the moment.
I'm the same.
Yeah,
I created a character that became my personality because I didn't want everyone to know how bloody weird I was.
I think for me, I don't know why. I felt different, but I didn't feel weird, but I just had this.
I didn't feel weird. I just knew I was different.
Yeah, but from a very young age, I just had this strong desire to please other people.
Yeah, I was a people pleaser.
And when I look back, I remember. Sounds really awful, but at Christmases I would get given presents, and I would have one response for everything, which would be
me too. I still do.
Like, oh my God, I love it! And I'd be thinking, I really didn't want this. They're like, oh, thanks. And I think to myself, that I remember that from as far back as I can remember.
Me too.
I learned to do that, because my kids, if you give them something and they don't love it, they're like, okay. Or, you know, they really are comfortable sharing their real opinion on something. They don't put up a front.
It's weird. I think mine comes from this suggestion that as children we were always supposed to be grateful and supposed to be compliant. And especially I'm a girl, so we're especially bred to be like that.
Yes.
And I think for me, I grew up with impeccable manners distilled upon me. And for me, I knew from a very young age it would have been considered very bad manners to not accept gratefully a gift. So I, even to this day, someone could buy me something that I just think, God, that's awful. They'd never know, and they never will.
There's a good book on all this, and maybe you've read it, but I just throw it out there for people who are listening. It's called Untamed by Glennon Doyle. Have you read that?
You know what? I haven't read it, but I got it because I buy lots of books and then I don't read them. They're all on my bedside table.
I have hundreds.
Yes, so do I.
This is one that's worth reading. It's really good. And
I think I will read that. I've gone upstairs. I will. It's a weird thing. It's sort of, I think that the society kind of boxes that we would have grown up in our time were to make life easy for us, so we were compliant and we just could have a nice life. And you know, having good manners was considered a really high point of good society and therefore looking like you didn't like something and someone went to all that effort of buying you that present, how dare you don't like that? So yeah. I even now to this day, I could think, Jesus, this is awful, but I would never say it because that I still believe that I would, it would be it'd be rude, which is hilarious.
Yeah.
But at the same time, if someone said to me they didn't like it, I'd be like, oh, great, I'll get you something else. That's fine. It's one-way traffic. It's so weird, you know?
So
I know, it's really, really weird. It's such a weird thing. It's all part of this one big thing of trying to figure out who you are and what you stand for, because that's the other thing is that, I don't know about you, but I didn't really have very strong moral boundaries.
No, I was kind of allowed to just kind of go out and be in the world and never really.
Yeah, I was as well.
I was supposed to be at home, or even if I was supposed to be home as a teenager, I always broke that and just never.
Yeah, I had quite a liberal sort of like, I think my parents realised that all my friends had quite strict deadlines, so I would just come home when they went home. But I can't even myself, I didn't have very strong boundaries of what I thought was okay. And alcohol made those boundaries even worse.
Yeah.
So now, and this is something I think you'll relate to, I said to you earlier, you've caught me at the best time in my sobriety because I feel so much happier about my sobriety now. Like, you know, for me, the thought of not being sober is devastating. Mm-hmm. It actually breaks my heart. And I'm actually not that proud of myself for getting sober because I don't do that very well. But I'm very proud of the fact that in my sobriety, one of my friends who also has HHD, who also had the same drinking problem, which was well hidden, when I told her I'd given up drinking, she drilled me about it and we had a really honest chat and she said, I'm going to do it. And I went, okay. And she's 50 days behind me and she's still sober. And every time she celebrates her sober anniversary, a little bit of me just goes...
Yeah, that's lovely. It's so lovely to impact somebody else's
life. That's the joy.
It's a real gift to be able to do that.
It is. And that for me is the pride. And it's sort of, and that's why I wanted to do this, because I wanted to tell people that it's not an instant thing. It's a work. It's a work of art. You are a work of art as a human, and you have to do the emotional work. You don't do it once. It's always happening, because once you give up drinking, you have to figure out who you are. And then once you know who you are, nobody can tell you anything and you're free.
Yeah.
And that's just, and none of that is possible if you're shit-faced drunk on rosé every day. Do you know what I mean? It's like you think you've got no time, you're overwhelmed. You haven't got any time because you're drunk. You know, you're overwhelmed.
Recovering from drinking.
You're recovering, yeah.
Or hyper-focusing on when you're going to drink at the weekend or in the week or what you're drinking, all the rules and all.
Yeah, and everything gets planned around this one little beastly little witch that just whispers in your ear the whole time, the wine witch. She's like, oh, look, it's sunny. You're like, oh, it's sunny. You're like, oh, bore off. You know what I mean? And since being sober... You know, I go on holiday. My first sober holiday was frightening. It absolutely terrified me. However, now my whole approach to thinking about going on holiday is different. I don't need an all-inclusive holiday anymore because guess what? I'm not going to drink the bar dry.
Yeah.
I don't need to, oh, I just go on holiday to lie by the pool. Not anymore. You know, it changes everything. It changes everything. It means that you're more aware. You've got more time. Getting up early. I'm a morning person. Love getting up early. It's the best, you know. And guess what? Eventually you do sleep. And eventually you wake up and your skin's great. Yeah. And then eventually one day you don't feel like shit. And eventually one day you know exactly who you are. And it's all clear and it's freedom.
Yeah.
Honestly, it's just, it really is a gift. But you have to do it yourself. And that is really hard. There's nothing worse than knowing the only person who can sort yourself out is yourself. It's just the worst.
And that with that comes a huge amount of discomfort and learning
so uncomfortable.
It's very uncomfortable. Yeah, it is.
It's so uncomfortable. And it's sad.
Yeah.
Because naturally reflect and then you'll feel sad.
Yeah.
And then that's okay. And you'll feel a bit upset and you'll feel a bit miffed. And then you'll be really angry. Why can't I have a drink like everybody else? That's not fair. Why can I go to a wedding? They're all having champagne and I'm having a tonic. Why can't I do that? This isn't fair. I'm so get really angry.
Yeah, it's and so true. It's so true.
And all those feelings, guess what? All those feelings are part of the human experience because we're not comfortable unless we feel happy. Happiness is a human obsession.
But we've also got too used to easing discomfort because so many things that we can instantly access to make ourselves feel better, and actually that isn't doing us any favors.
Really not. You've got a whole bunch of people who are just sort of hitting a point in life in society where we're a real turning point in our society. You just have to sort of, you can feel it in the air. You and I can more than most other people because we've got special sense, but you can feel it. There's a level of kind of civil unrest in people, and there's a level of awakening as a society. It's in our politics, it's our economy, it's in everything. But also there's a lot of people thinking, God, I feel terrible. All the things I thought that were going to tick the box of feeling great, they don't work. Yeah. I feel terrible. Mm-hmm. And one day I'm going to have to deal with that. And it's just, you know, it's a question of time, isn't it? Like,
yeah.
I'm not saying that everybody sort of gets sober and suddenly they're like, yes, this is all, my life is here, because that's not what it's about. It's about realizing it doesn't work for you.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I realized. It doesn't work for me. And I can actually visualize having what my life will look like in the future. Yeah. And guess what? I don't actually know what it's going to look like because I've got opportunity to do whatever I want.
Yeah.
Whereas before, I could have just told you I'd be doing the same thing for the end of time.
Yeah.
It's weird, isn't it?
And on that note, what would your 3 tips be for someone that's listening now that wants to access that? You know, what would you recommend they do to help them get sober or stay sober?
You know what? I think these are probably a little bit unconventional, but I think the first thing you should do is have a really good chat with yourself in the mirror and just think about what would you like your life to be. And if you don't know what that looks like because you're too covered in alcohol, then try and find one thing to do that helps you, whether it be finding your people, find a world where being sober is not the rarity. You know, you need to find your people. It's hard. I didn't do this and I wish I had. I wish I'd gone and found my people. I wish I'd gone and found a community of people who are sober. I'm not talking about people who are sort of dissing alcohol every day. I'm talking about people who, especially if you're a woman, you need to find a sister tribe. You need to find a tribe for everything in life. I only realize this now as a solitary person. I could have done with a real tribe really young and I've never had one really. I have one now. It's quite small, but it's perfect. You know, find a tribe. And if that's not in your immediate world, you're going to have to make a big decision to find it. And guess what? You don't have to tell everyone what you're doing. It's none of their business. It isn't. You can do it yourself. And the other thing I'd say is if you need to socialize and you know that's going to be a nightmare, don't go. Don't go. Whatever you do, make up an excuse. Say you're sick. Get a migraine. Just don't go. It doesn't matter. Don't go. Because the thing is, you can't, you know, in the famous words, if you do what you've always done, you'll get what you always get. Don't go to the pub. All of a sudden you go to the pub and realize that you have to use a disgusting, stinky toilet that when you're sober is rank, because every pub in Britain has a rank toilet. You know, it's like when you take out the alcohol of the situation, would you really want to do it? No, you wouldn't. And also, if people around you don't want to be part of it, just keep them out of it, you know. Look after yourself and not be selfish. That's the wrong word. Be mindful of what you need, you know. Really dip out and just take yourself out of the situation, you know. Join a club, read some good books, get educated about what alcohol does to you, because when you start to think about it, it starts to bother you. And if you're a woman, especially if you're a woman and you're going to perimenopause, the worst thing you can do is drink. It absolutely ruins the whole experience for you. So I would do that. Try and find your people, be mindful and be vigilant, because alcohol is sneaky. It's sneaky. It sneaks in. Just be vigilant, you know, and that's pretty much it. You also have to really want it. You really do. You really have to want something different. You almost have to have a bit of a hard chat, you know. I mean, I have to be honest. Anyone who knows me, who cares about me, who invites me to a bottomless brunch is being insensitive. It's kind of that. You need to be around people who care enough about you that they won't sort of make you derail.
Mm.
Because the minute you tell someone you've given up alcohol, you get two reactions. The first time I told I told one of my friends and she went, "Oh my God, good for you." I told her in the kitchen. She went, "Good for you. That's amazing. Well done." And then from that day on, her house always had loads of the non-alcoholic drinks I like to drink. I told another friend who went, "Really? We didn't drink that much anyway. I didn't think you ever looked like you had an alcohol problem." I'm like, well, no, because I hid it really well.
Or maybe because you're also drunk, you didn't see it.
Yeah, exactly. It makes people feel a little bit unhinged about their own alcohol.
Yeah.
So it kind of, you get two reactions and sort of, you know, I definitely get resources, definitely kind of make a commitment to yourself, and you don't have to tell anyone what you're doing. And the other thing I'd say is just trust the process. Hang in there. Trust the process. If anything was easy, it wouldn't happen. We can do hard things. And the only reason this is hard is because we live in a society that's absolutely obsessed with alcohol.
Yeah.
End of. That's it. You know?
Yeah, a lot there. A lot of really, really useful
tips. There is a lot there. I'm so sorry. That wasn't three things. It was 17 things mixed in with a load of other crap.
Definitely had six things there. Yeah. So, but that's fine. That's okay. It doesn't matter. Six very useful things.
Yeah. And the one thing I would say also is change your content to who you follow on social media. That's really important, because you won't notice it until you don't drink. But the amount of accounts of my friends and people I know who all their accounts are full of them drinking and having the best time.
Yeah.
Watch out for it. And once you see it, you can never unsee it. Yeah. I'm not saying anyone shouldn't drink. That's up to them. But for me, it's absolute no. And I'm much happier now because of it. 4-year slog.
Oh, well done. You've done amazing. And I'm so happy to have been able to have this conversation and to get into your world and be able to explore some topics that, you know, other people I think will find really helpful, really useful.
So it's sort of unpopular opinion. I actually realize that you're the first person I've actually ever laid it out to, ever.
I feel very, very touched by that.
No, well, I think that you're a safe space, and I recognise my own kind, and I feel like, you know, I could actually be myself with you, which is really amazing. So thank you so much for holding that space for me. It's amazing. And if anyone who watches this ever wants a pep talk from me, they can get straight to me on Instagram and ask me, and I will talk about it and give all the advice and resources to anyone who wants to know. Because helping other people is what the joy is.
And how do we find you on that note?
Oh, dear. So I don't actually run an account on Instagram about sobriety. I run an account about my outfits and being middle-aged, mainly because since stopping drinking, I joined Instagram and had the time and effort to be able to dress nicely again. And you can find me being a twerp at Flouncing About, literally Flouncing About.
At Flouncing About.
Yeah, that is my handle.
Love it.
Because now that you've met me, surely you realise no one else can have that but me.
I love it. It does seem very fitting.
It is fitting.
Really dressed. And I'm afraid, I'm sorry, I'm not, I don't put the videos out, otherwise they would see that gorgeous outfit that you're wearing, but it will just be audio.
No, audio is good. In fact, audio is probably better because
audio's better.
It's a podcast.
Yeah, I'm not quite there with the video yet. But no, it's been lovely to talk to you, Steph. Thank you so much again. And thank you to everyone else. And please feel free to reach out to either of us.
Yeah, please feel free.
Talk more, especially about the ADHD side of things, because I know that there are a lot of people on that neurodivergent journey.
And do you know what? For women, ADHD and alcohol are like literal bed partners that should never be in bed together.
There we go. Goodbye, everyone. Until next
time. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for listening to this podcast. If you're interested in being a guest, please contact me directly on Instagram by sending a message to @sassysobermum. You can also find helpful tools and resources on my website, sassysobermum.com. If you enjoyed the podcast and you want to spread the love, please like, share, and rate the podcast. I really look forward to next time. See you then.